I like the noise, like hearing yourself speak, it's great. Who enjoyed the party last night? Well, there was at least three people that said, yeah. Who enjoyed it? I don't want to confess to that. Did you get to go in the car? Yeah, that was pretty sweet, wasn't it? 100 miles an hour? Because none of you have ever done that before. Yeah. So, I assume we're in the right session. Let's wait for that to load. Anybody who's not in the right session, you're welcome to stay. So we're going to talk about some... We're going to talk about what I refer to as the boring topics, really. Security is one of those things that no one likes to talk about. It's not really an exciting topic, but I'm going to try and make it as exciting as we can do. And just so you know, I do pace up and down quite a bit. So if you start to feel sick, just kind of let me know and I'll stand still for a bit. But I do walk it up and down. So a little bit about me, if you've not seen me before. There we go. I'm a solution architect. I work for Protivity. We're based all over the place. I'm one of those SharePoint MVP guys. I'm one of the techie guys. I like to, I'm sure there's a whole bunch. Let's do a show of hands. Who's a developer? Aren't you on the wrong floor? Like, aren't you supposed to be on floor 5? Who's a admin, IT pro? Who doesn't really care? Yeah, there's always a few of those. That's right. Like, I don't care. Whatever I get told to do. So I'm one of the techie guys for SharePoint. I have done for a while. Are you one of these? Do you dream about SharePoint? Yeah, nightmares. I have dreams. I don't remember them. But when I have nightmares, they are normally about SharePoint. You can follow me on Twitter. I have 2 accounts. Hello, it's Liam. And Hack SharePoint. We're not going to talk about hacking SharePoint today, but we'll talk about other stuff. And my blog site right there, so you can follow me, whatever else. If you do want to follow me, and I don't know who you are, just tell me where I met you. It's much easier. Like, hey, I know you. Like, I have no idea. So if you did say hi, like, by all means. So what are we going to talk about? We could talk about authentication, authorization, talk about claims, OAuth, protecting content, and protecting our infrastructure. We'll kind of wrap everything up together. Because really, security is about that. It's about the boring side of it. I'm not going to talk to you about how to put permissions on a folder or a file, because I'm hoping that most people in this room would know how to do that. But by all means, I can show you how to assign permissions if you really want to. So why am I talking about this? So for the past 18 months, maybe 2 years, I've kind of focused solely speaking on security. Everything from hacking SharePoint to trying to do data breaches to securing content, to all kinds of different things. And it kind of stems from this. I'm sure you've all seen a bunch of hacks. Maybe some of you are the hackers, but you'll never confess to it. No one ever confesses to being a hacker, unless they're very proud of that moment. But these guys, Burger King got hacked. Facebook, McDonald's, MIT, Jeep, Apple, NBC. Yeah, I won't mention these guys, but they got hacked too. You might know them. Citigroup got hacked. Telecoms company, Chase, the New York Times, Bank of America, ITV, PlayStation, Living Social, CNN, Adobe. That was a sweet hack, that was. That was just that's just ridiculous. I mean, how do you hack something and then steal the source code? How is that even possible? What did you do that wrong in the environment that some random person could steal the source code of the Adobe products? Did you just literally plug it into the internet? There we go. These guys, you might have heard this one recently, Bitcoin, the largest Bitcoin place, got hacked, and they're there filing for bankruptcy and a whole bunch of other stuff. These guys, the magical logo that the teenage kids like, that's for sending those funny pictures. Snapchat. Skype, yep, Skype got hacked. Oh, you might recognize that logo. Xbox Twitter account got hacked by the Syrian Electronic Cyber Army. That was fantastic. GitHub, Michaels, if you go shopping and buy all that kind of stuff. Neiman Marcus, the store, the BAFTA website in the UK got hacked. This is the one. And I made this as big as I could so it was quite clear what the issue was. And you know what? I was one of those people. My credit card, yeah. I had a phone call from Chase Bank who called me and said, Mr. Cleary, you seem to have spent almost $1,000 online. No. Apparently I had. I'd spent $1,000 at Ralph Lauren, which was quite intriguing, seeing as I don't own any Ralph Lauren clothes. But apparently I did. Then they cancelled my account, and then they tracked it back, and it was because I'd used my card at Target, and they got my details. So I was one of those people. But this was fantastic, wasn't it? When you peel back the layers of how that hack took place, it was very simple. It was credentials that got taken from a vendor and then passed through and malware put on the machines, and then, vroom, done. This to date is probably one of the largest hacks that has took place so far. Now, of course, outside of this, we have denial of service attacks. Some of the largest denial of service attacks have been taking place over the past couple of months. I mean, we're talking 100 gig per second denial of service attacks. The largest one so far was 400 gig per second. That's just ridiculous. So they're taking control of your workstations while you're at work when you're supposed to be working. And they're using your machines against you to do a denial of service attack against stuff. Do you think anybody's hacking SharePoint? We all hack SharePoint to make it work. What are you on about? Of course not. Who uses SharePoint out of the box? Exactly. And I've just figured out how to make it work. That's everybody. We all hack it to make it work. So there's an inherent kind of built in to us that we have to kind of figure something out to break it or make it do something it wasn't intended to do. This is the issue that we face right now with SharePoint. I have a bunch of tools that I use. I'm a bit of a Linux fan. I like to use Linux to do stuff. And you can run a bunch of Linux stuff. I have a script that I wrote that will do a bunch of stuff that I'm not going to tell you. But it'll go to SharePoint and do a bunch of stuff. And it's fantastic. Because there's such a vast kind of surface area of attack for SharePoint. SharePoint's not a small product. So let's do it. Let's do a show of hands. I always like this one. Who thinks they know 50% of everything in SharePoint? Not even. Oh, there he is. There's always one. I know 50% of everything in SharePoint. Who knows about 25% of what SharePoint can do? Yeah, that's a bit better. Yeah. So if we don't know exactly how SharePoint works and how it really goes together, then we're kind of vulnerable to mistakes. And that's really what we're talking about. We're talking about configuration mistakes. We're talking about, oh, we just gave it to the empowering the users. The weird statement, that one. You want to empower your business users who don't know how to use SharePoint to look after security for SharePoint. They're the ones that write their passwords on sticky notes and put them on the monitor. And so you want to use them. Yeah, you look after security. We're empowering you to make sure no one gets in. And then you go into Google or the Bing, and you do a search, and you can find a whole bunch of websites that are publicly accessible, and there's loads of stuff. Like, why is that even there? Did you not switch on the feature to turn it off? Apparently not. So this is why we're talking about it. We're talking about it because it's an issue. It's not going to go away. It's going to get worse. So if you have a SharePoint environment that's on the internet, it's time for you to kind of look at it. Did you know that if you do a search across the internet, here in the US at least, that about 25% of all SharePoint implementations that are kind of vulnerable to things sit inside the Comcast business network? So I don't know if any of you use Comcast business, but you might want to check there. There's about another 50% of those that sit inside Amazon. Amazon don't look after them. You go and get some VMs in Amazon and you stick them up there and go, it's secure. And then there's a fantastic website called Shodan HQ that goes ahead and crawls all your SharePoint sites for you. And then people like me can go and have a look and I can do all kinds of weird stuff to the site. If you ever get bored one day, website www.shodanhq.com and do a search for IP cameras. I'm going to leave it at that. But there's some great ones you can have a look at. Because people don't change passwords. What's the default password for some of the wireless internet routers that you get? It's going to be password. So when they get crawled on the internet and you go to and find where it is, you can get access to a video stream that you shouldn't have access to. How do you think the NSA get it? So let's talk about authentication. So what kind of types do we have in SharePoint then? So we're going to talk about just Windows. Everyone does this one. Who's using SharePoint with regular Windows AD authentication? Normally a pretty high, okay? So this is standard, isn't it? We're talking about MTLM, we're talking about Kerberos, we're talking about basic auth, anonymous access bundles into that one, and we're talking about digest. This is the standard. You get SharePoint, you put the media in, you go install, da-da, it just works. And then everybody messes it up. So what else do we have? Well, we have forms-based authentication. Who's using forms-based auth of some description? Okay, a little bit less, kind of expect there. So we're talking LDAP, Microsoft SQL Server, ASP.NET membership role providers, which gives you a vast array of kind of things that you can go into. So there's kind of like two base ones. If you notice, these ones are kind of like the Windows and the FBA kind of idea. But of course, Microsoft, in their wisdom, realized that not everybody uses Active Directory. I know it's really weird. Not everybody likes to use AD. Not everybody likes to authenticate and pay licenses to have people authenticate using AD. So they have different options. So the forms base was the first one. Great idea. Involves a bunch of customization to make stuff work properly. So what did they introduce? SAML and OAuth kind of authentication. So who's using SAML-based authentication? So I'm talking ADFS, I'm talking Azure. So yeah, so even less subset. Because it's a little bit more complicated, and it's nothing to do with SharePoint. Like the complication of using SAML authentication has nothing to do with SharePoint. It's to do with it being SAML authentication in the first place and how that goes together. So we're talking Active Directory Federated Services. We're talking custom identity providers built on the WIF.NET framework. We're talking about LDAP connections, and we're talking about Windows Azure services. Four kind of different approaches to achieving the same thing, but ultimately, it's an encrypted piece of XML that comes back with a token, with a bunch of attributes that allow you to authenticate users back into the site. And then, of course, we have OAuth. OAuth has been around for a long time, and everyone's kind of stayed away from it. But this time, it's been brought in specifically for the whole app model and secure server. Who's using apps right now? That's about as many as I expected. Who's actually writing apps right now? That's what I expected too. Massive range of three people in an entire room. But this will grow because this is a fantastic design. Going to an OAuth model and abstracting everything away and then basing it on a token is kind of mapping everything to the way that SAML authentication works, which is I don't care where you get authenticated. I don't want to store usernames and passwords anymore because that means I have to have someone who can manage that. So I'm going to go to a SAML-based authentication and I'm going to have you use Facebook to log in. I suppose the real answer should be we should be using Live ID. So we're going to use Live ID to get in instead. And then I don't have to worry about that. If my password gets locked out, not my problem. I have to go to Live ID and get that reset. Or you could use Google, or you could use Yahoo, whatever you wanted to. So this is why we choose this kind of design. So let's talk about the two different words, authentication versus authorization. We'll just do a show of hands, and hopefully everybody gets this right. Does SharePoint perform authentication, yes or no? Let's do a yes. Arms in the air if you think SharePoint does authentication. I like it. Or no one really knows and they don't want to put their hands up. So they're all sitting there going, well, no one's put their hand up yet, so I'm not going to do it. They're kind of like, yeah, I'm down here. What about authorization? Does SharePoint do authorization? Yes, congratulations. Gold stars for everybody. I don't have any gold stars to give you, but there you go. So authentication is the verification of a claim. And historically, the verification of that claim is my username and password. That's what that is. So in the morning, you turn up your laptop, it logs into the domain, you open up the SharePoint site, there's a single sign-on process that takes place that no one really understands how that works, but actually it's IIS, passing credentials that you've already got, and goes into SharePoint, and hey, presto, it works. But it's just a verification of that process. But then authorization is the verification of the permissions that you have assigned to you. So let's think of that logic. So I wake up in the morning, go to the laptop, because that's the first thing I do. I wake up and go, someone's emailed me. I have to get up and check. Do a raise of hands. Who picks up their cell phone? Like the first thing they pick up in the morning is their cell phone. They're just a side note. Do we not realize how sad that really is? you wake up in the morning and go, no one's texted me. But I've got 1,000 Facebook alerts, which mean nothing. I mean, do we not find that weird that we wake up in the morning, we grab the phone, and you walk to the bathroom, because that's, no, I'm not going to go there. But you have the phone, and you look at it and go, someone sent me, someone's telling me they're eating a cheese sandwich. That's fantastic. I feel so much happier now. But we do, we need this habit of posting things. So authorization in the SharePoint world is, I've already logged in, I'm now going to access a team site, and the team site says, do you belong in this group, yes or no? So we do an ACL comparison at that point. That's the verification, that's the authorization. Authentication precedes authorization. You can't be authorized until you've actually been authenticated somewhere. I mean, how funny would that be? You go to the bank and you say, I would like to take out $100,000 out of the bank. And they go, yes, sir, and just give it to you. And then they go, what account was that for? Don't worry about it, it'll be fine. That's not how that works. You have to physically authenticate yourself there. What's the exception? Anonymous comments on a blog. Because you're inherently authorized. Well, actually, you're not authorized. It's running in a process that authorizes you for you. Anonymous users are already authorized, but remember, you are not authenticated. Don't think you're authenticated just because an anonymous user can do stuff. You're just authorized to do something. And this one's an important one. You often forget that authentication can be broken, but to break authorization is significantly more complicated. Because you have to be, so taking SharePoint as the example, because obviously that's why we're here, that when you come to the SharePoint site, you obviously have to be authenticated, otherwise you get stuck in that stupid loop, or it just says, sorry, this site is not shared with you, which has to be the randomest message ever. Or you get that stupid access request thing, which of course never works, because you fill it in and then it goes to the person, they're like, who is that? That's like when I get Facebook requests and I'm like, I don't know, oh, they had the same friends as me, I will add them. Now you tell me you don't do that. The first thing you look at Facebook is you get a friend request and it says, who are the mutual friends that we have together? You may not even know that person, but if you have mutual friends, we will be friends. Just, that's how that works. So, let's talk about authorization a little bit more. SharePoint does this after the authentication process. So there's basically three kind of steps that go into it. The first one is we're going to say, is the user a member of some security group that you've assigned? So let's talk about Active Directory groups. So do you belong to members? Do you belong to domain users? Whatever permission's been assigned. But it also could be, is the user added, is the account added to the ACL, the access control list of the physical object that you're trying to get to? Now, bear in mind, in SharePoint, you have a lot of inheritance. So your permission could be at the site level, but you're actually accessing a file, but it's still going to do the same check. It'll say, well, do you have, oh, hold on a minute, it's inherited, so yes, you do. Or if we're using new sexy SAML, that's the new phrase for today, sexy SAML, is that do you have the required attributes to get to that information? Because, of course, moving to a SAML-based, we may not be using security groups. We could be using some attribute that came from a third-party application. So, for example, it could be some information you pull from your HR application. At the point of login, you grab details about you from HR, it goes to the SharePoint site, and we say, oh, if you happen to have this, if you happen to wear red shoes on a Saturday and a blonde wig, then you can get access to the SharePoint site. So you can pass those attributes as part of that process. Everyone needs to understand this. It's a very simple line. SharePoint only understands what you tell it. It's not a mystical wizard where it just goes, I know what you want to do. You don't want to allow everyone to get to the website, so I will restrict that for you, but you've just changed it and said you want it to. SharePoint only understands what you configure and tell. 9 times out of 10, when we get a phone call and there's an issue with security, it's because somebody's changed something, and they go, well, I don't know how it changed. SharePoint, it just did it. Because there's an inherent process in SharePoint, that Microsoft put in there that randomly changes permissions every half an hour. Have you not seen it? It just goes in and goes, no, yes. So anybody who, there's your app idea. Yeah, you create an app, you put it in the store, call it something else, but what does it do in the background? Just changes permissions. And then every time it changes permissions, it doesn't work, it sends you an email, and you go, I will call you with an invoice so I can fix that. But yeah, so just because you are logged in does not authorize you. And this is great. So I'm going to stand by a statement. I make this statement a lot. SharePoint, out of the box, is secure. SharePoint, out of the box, is secure. I'm very careful with the wording. I get the ISO image. I install it. It's on my new machine. It's on my domain. It's secure. You take that machine, you plug it in the internet, and you say, anonymous users, check. Yeah. Now you've just broken the security policy at that point. But you may need to. So out of the box, it is secure. By default, it's set to deny. Have you ever noticed that? By default, it will deny you access. Historically, it would just say, access denied. And obviously, people got offended by that. So now we have the sorry message. Which means something completely different, doesn't it? It's like, access is denied. Sorry, it's not shared with you. Why does no one love me? Like, that's the kind of feeling that you get from it. Like, I'm not loved anymore. No one shares stuff with me. So what's the best approach to authorization? Well, it's going to be Active Directory groups. Too often, and I tell people this, stop shoving individual users just in the SharePoint site. There's groups for a reason. It's very straightforward. You put them into Active Directory groups, and you assign the Active Directory group, hopefully to a SharePoint site group that has the permission and it inherits. So what do? We get the chief execs and just randomly add them all over the place. And then when they leave, they say, what permission has Steve got? I have no idea. And then we have to buy a product because the out-of-the-box doesn't get all the stuff properly to figure out where we assign permissions. If we're to put them in a group, it's really straightforward. Let's put them in a group. Roles from a membership and role provider. That's why we have a thing called a role provider. It's the equivalent of security groups. And then claims associated to users. When you move to a SAML-based authentication, we can get away from groups. We can have an attribute associated and assign permissions that way. It makes life way easier. Obviously, to do that, you have to have a custom claim provider, and you can call them whatever you want. You can call those attributes whatever you want to. You can make them look like groups. The downside to moving to a SAML-based authentication is the petal picker doesn't quite work, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. So, let's go through Active Directory. This is the classic authorization approach. Very straightforward. This is the one member, out of the box, it's secure. Very straightforward. Single sign-on. Do you get single sign-on? I've got two SharePoint web apps on the same farm using Active Directory. I go to the one, it single signs me in, and then I click on the next one, do I get single signed on? Let's do a vote. Let's do yes. Yes. I don't know. It's a trick question. But it is. It's a trick question because if you haven't added the URLs to the browser to do auto-login, then, of course, it's going to prompt you every time, which personally, by design, that's ridiculous that you have to add it to a browser setting to be able to do an auto-login as soon as you're on the domain. But if you have two web apps that are configured for AD and you put them in the auto-login zone, then you'll get single sign-on. It's not really single sign-on. Because all you're doing is you're reposting the credentials that you've stored on the machine back every single time you go to it. That's just how that works. You just don't see that. You're like, single sign-on, sweet. No, we're just reposting every single time. The people picker, it's full name resolution. How does it do that? LDAP connection straight to Active Directory. You type in Bob and it goes and finds Bob. And then you can assign permissions to Bob. That's how that works. Any specific configuration? Nope, it just does it. Any custom components for SharePoint we have to build? Nope. Just works. It's great. But that doesn't work for every scenario. So, how does the authentication process work then? So let's draw some boxes. So we've got my AD kind of over here and over there. Just I forgot there's another one over there. You mean you can't see the red dot over there? No. So we've got AD, SharePoint, and we've got me sitting over there. I dress up in a blue outfit quite frequently. So that's what I'm dressed as. So the very first request to a SharePoint site in the morning, the fact that you're logged in is always anonymous. Everyone's going, no, I'm logged in. No, trust me, the very first request is always anonymous. It hits the site and it says, I don't know who you are. And so it makes the request, then it requests the Windows credentials, which it does very, very quickly, you don't see that. And then it sends the Windows credentials, because we already have those on the machine. Now, bear in mind, it could have prompted you at that point instead, but either way, you're going to send credentials back in that process. Once it's done that, we're going to validate the credentials against Active Directory, which is done via the IIS process. We obtain the group membership list. So this is important to note. At that point, we grab security groups that you're assigned to, We send it all the way back through SharePoint, and it creates a security token and an authentication token, which is wrapped up inside the secure token store service that's built into SharePoint. Wraps it all up in a component, and then sends the web page, requests the web page again, having reposted all of that information back in the request. Now, you don't see that. If you use Fiddler and stuff like that, you can see the authent token coming back, but that's what you get in Active Directory. It's very simple, very straightforward. So, what about this one? Membership and role providers. A few people are using them. You can support all kinds of authentication. It's custom code. You have to write this. Or you're going to use the out-of-the-box Microsoft ones. So you're going to use SQL. You're going to use LDAP. You're going to use whatever else. But it can support any kind of. Single sign-on? Nah. You've got to build that yourself. There's no out-of-the-box single sign-on for a forms-based authentication. Because you get that stupid forms-based login page, which is just doesn't do anything. That really... Like, it used to be the weird kind of yellowy color, and now it's like a white one with nothing. So you obviously want to change that. You want to create your own login controls. You want to do all kinds of... So it's a custom solution. People picker still works. Name resolution, you still get them. If you want to do something clever, you have to build a custom claim provider to kind of fix that process, but you get name resolution. Specific configuration, this one's a pain. So let's see how smart everybody is. How many web configs do we have to change for a membership and role provider? 3, nice. So the 3 would be the website itself, central admin, secure store. Of course, no one makes mistakes in a web config, do they? Ever. No one's ever put something in there and gone, why am I getting that weird error? Like, but yes, you make specific configurations. Do we need custom components? Unless you're going to use the out-of-the-box, awful-looking page, then yes, you're going to. You're going to need some kind of custom logic, some welcome control, login controls, whatever else you want it to be to handle session, to handle auto-logon, single sign-on. So how does this process work? Same idea. This time we've got a database. We're going to use SQL. Request the page anonymously. We're going to send it to the forms-based login page. The forms-based login page is then going to come up and say, hey, credentials. We're going to pass credentials. We're going to validate to the user store. Exactly the same idea. We're going to obtain the role membership. Obviously, we're not getting security groups, but the equivalent of them at that point. We're going to create the security token, authent token, and a cookie this time if we decide to go that process. Because obviously we're using forms-based now, we need to use the .NET kind of cookie components to be able to do that sign-in. And then we're going to send the component all the way back and you get the web page. So two very similar approaches, very straightforward. So let's move on. Let's talk about this one. We're going to talk about SAML kind of based authentication. So if we move to an ADFS environment, for example, do we get inherent single sign-on? Does it just work? So if I have two websites, again, same idea, SharePoint Farm, two web applications. I configure them both for ADFS authentication. Do I get single sign-on? Yes, you do get single sign-on. Because when you authenticate to the one, and then you hit the next one, there's a bunch of voodoo magic that goes on in the background, and it will sign you back in again. It's literally voodoo magic. The people picker becomes a string comparison tool at that point. I'm sure you've seen this if you put ADFS in or something else, that when you go and do a name resolution and you type in, I like to use the test phrase dog turd, because there's no user account that exists in any Active Directory that I've looked at that's dog turd. So, of course, it shouldn't come back, should it? But when I type it, I get like 57 of them come back because it has no idea how to look for that name. It just says, oh, hold on a minute, you've got like 6 claims come back. Oh, yes, there's a claim called email address with the text, dog turd. Which doesn't help your end user, does it? So they're sitting there going, I need to add Steve. There's 15 of them. Which one is it? Well, do you not know what the claims are? I know what claims are, what's that? And then you end up with this issue. So we have to have a claim provider that fixes that process. Obviously, for you guys, the IT people, you'll know what it means. Because you'll know that when you added it using PowerShell, that the claims went in, email address, UPN, role, you'll know what they are. The end user has no idea. Do we need specific configuration? Well, no, not really. It's just a piece of PowerShell. It's a PowerShell and an SSL certificate, or multiple SSL certificates, depending on how you've got the root chains all the way down. Custom components? Possibly. You're going to want some custom components. Maybe you don't like the ADFS login process. maybe you want to have just a login control on the page that calls ADFS, then it's custom components at that point. PowerShell, and yes, I like this idea because it requires trusted certificates to work. It's not like anybody can just say, use my ADFS. It just doesn't work because you have to have certificate trust all the way through. So how does this process work? Now we're going to expand it. We've got another server. So we have our Active Directory, we have our ADFS, we have our SharePoint, we have the whole process. So let's see how this works. So you'll see there's an inherent trust between everything on that right-hand side. Active Directory trusts ADFS. ADFS has a trust to SharePoint, and it's done using that certificate process. The certificate is passed between them so the secure communication can be done. And it's done over SSL, so it's all encrypted between that end. So the web page is requested anonymously again. We obtain the login page from the provider. It could be ADFS, it could be Windows Azure, it could be any number of third-party vendors that you might be using that does this process, but you'll be prompted for an authentication process request. It'll request a SAML security token, which really is a piece of XML. That's all it is, just a long piece of XML with an X509 certificate binary wrapped around the side of it, and then your attributes that get spit out. You validate credentials against the identifier, which could be anything. You send the SAML security token. We wrap all that back up in SharePoint into an authent security token, and then it gets passed all the way through. So our ending goal is very much the same. Now, the difference is with this one, the users will inherently see a redirect. That's what normally happens. So anybody's got a Hotmail account, a live ID, you'll log into your Hotmail account, and then you see that redirect. Anybody's gone to Office 365, and you type in your email address, it does that redirect process. And if you don't know what you're looking for, look in the URL. It'll say WA sign in 1.0. Then you'll know that you're actually using some kind of identity process for doing redirects. So what about Windows Azure? Who's using Windows Azure for authentication? A couple of people. So Windows Azure, this is the Microsoft Federated Cloud. This is them taking ADFS and making it slightly better and making it so it can kind of communicate with other third-party applications. So it supports SAML 1 and 2. It supports Facebook, Google, Windows Live ID, Yahoo, ADFS, anything that's kind of open ID and custom identity providers. So this one's a great one because we can now build a solution that wraps around lots and lots of third-party vendors to authenticate. Not that you would ever want anyone to authenticate to your SharePoint site using Facebook. I mean, really, corporate users accessing SharePoint via a Facebook account. That's like an oxymoron right there. So, support for third-party integration and claim mapping is done through the configuration. So we can take a claim that comes in, transform that to something else, and send it back into SharePoint. And obviously, all of the providers have multiple claims. So how does the process work? It's not the slide that I wanted. We'll come back to that one in a second. I want to go to this one. Okay, so here's my Windows Azure environment. We're connected to all of those vendors right there on the right-hand side. So Twitter, Facebook, Google, Yahoo, LinkedIn, whatever it might be. So we have an inherent trust between all of those providers, and then up here, which would be the Windows Azure piece in the middle. So now, because I'm going to be connecting my SharePoint environment to the Windows Azure service, I can now get access to all of those. So I'm going to request the web page again, anonymously, first time. I'm going to send it to the ACS provider. The provider's then going to kind of spoof me over to where I need to go. So in this instance, I'm redirected to the Twitter login page. And you've seen that little login page that comes up. So you go to that page, pass credentials. I then get sent back from the client because that's where the process happens. We send the credentials to the provider. The user's authenticated to and redirected to Azure ACS. So just think the process through. I've hopped from my machine to the SharePoint box to Windows Azure. Windows Azure has thrown me out to Twitter. So I'm now 57 layers away from where I started. I pass credentials into here, which is Twitter. That validates, then throws them back into ACS. ACS then consumes that and says, well, I trust you, so yes, let's make a SAML token. So it creates a SAML token, and then it wraps it up with the provider from ACS, and then validates and sends it back into SharePoint, when it then gets rewrapped again using the SharePoint STS process, and then goes and creates the token, and then you get the page. And you see that process. And if you ever get bored one day and you want to do it, configure it, open up Fiddler, and tell me how many redirects you get. Because there's quite a few. You can see it going backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards. So, why did we talk about authentication and authorization? Hopefully you would all know about that. But that's because security starts there, doesn't it? That's the first place. How do you get your users into the site? Where are they coming from? How are they going to authenticate? Because then you can then apply security to those accounts that come back in. Now, to understand how SharePoint works, we have to understand this bad boy here. Anybody understand claims? 100%. Yeah, there's a couple of people. Claims are really straightforward. You have those now. So when we look at claims, we have a couple of kind of terms that we use. The first one is the identity of the individual. And you all have those. So there's a driving license from Virginia. There's my identity. This is me. Well, obviously it's not me, but this is me right here. That's my identity. Then I have the claim, and if you notice, the claim is some of these here. So on the Virginia driving license, you obviously get height and eye color and things like that. Those are the attributes, those are the claims that when you get stopped by the police, not that anybody's ever got stopped by the police here, ever, that they will present and say, hold on a minute, it says that you're 6'7", which I quite clearly am. What are you laughing at? I'm taller than you right now. And then we have the token which is the kind of the binary, the identity of the claims and the signature of where it all came from. And then we have the issuer, and in this case, the issuer is the DMV. So we have these in our world today. That's why it was introduced into the SharePoint world and into just regular computing, because this is what we use right now. This is, I claim to be this person. These are the attributes that will authenticate me and authorize me, and this is how it gets wrapped up because I trust that provider. Because obviously, you're driving the car, you get pulled over, the police officer is going to ask you to, well, if you're here, he's going to ask you to stay in the car. They don't seem to like you getting out the car. They tend to shout at you when you get out the car as well, which is quite weird. But they will look at your driving license and your registration because those are the two pieces of identification that will, one, validate you. And the only reason they ask for your driving license is obviously to make sure it's you on the picture, because obviously me and him are not the same. So that would cause me an issue. But he trusts the driving license inherently, like SharePoint trusts an identity provider because of the SSL certificate that's been passed. But the police officer trusts this because of the issuer, which is the DMV. So when we're talking about claims and how claims works, it's all about this trust that you have with the provider. What are you doing with this? Then we have the relying party. The relying party for this instance is what you're trying to get to. So for us, that's going to be SharePoint. SharePoint's what we're trying to get to. That's the relying party. So what about claims augmentation? Now, we talked earlier, and we talked about you go through SAML authentication and you can assign permissions to an attribute. Now, obviously, if you're using an Active Directory and then you have ADFS, the only attributes you're going to get are from the Active Directory itself. And unless you've extended the schema and added a whole bunch of weirdness in there, it's going to be regular AD fields. But you can augment this process by saying, you know, we're using PeopleSoft or we're using SAP or something else. How cool would it be if when I log in, we go and grab information from that process to augment the claims that you've already got from the authentication process and pass those into SharePoint. And that becomes quite important because when you're doing security, instead of having to create 1,000 security groups to match every combination of what you would need, we can now start to apply security to an attribute. So claims augmentation allows us to inject other pieces of information at the point of authentication and pass it back inside the SAML token. Why would you need to? Because you might want to retrieve information from the line of business application, or you might want to validate against another application and authenticate at the same time, so you get that information back. What are the types of augmentation that we have? So for example, you have Federation Gateway, SharePoint ones, and custom ones. The Federation Gateway would be like ADFS or Windows Azure services, whatever it would be, and this allows us to do transformations of incoming to outgoing. So we can say, well, I've got these ones here, and I want this to come out something different, and I want to add this to that. SharePoint also lets you do claims mappings. Anybody who's ever added an identity provider directly into SharePoint knows that when you do the PowerShell, you have to specify the claim mappings. And 9 times out of 10, everyone just goes, well, I want to use that field and just leave it as the same. But you can transform it at that point to something else. So you could take role as an incoming claim and map that out to something else called security groups so that your end user can kind of see what they're looking for. And then, of course, with the custom, you can append claim attributes at any point. So how does the processing work? So let's talk about the identity platform. So we go to the identity platform, we log in. This then sends me some claims. So we go through the in and out process. So we log in, we get the claims, we go in, we get them, it hits the Federation Gateway, and it starts generating these attributes for us and then spits those back out again. So we've got this processing engine that takes place right here. Transformation takes place inside that engine. So it looks through the rules. So if we're using ADFS, for example, it'll say, hold on a minute, here's my issuance rules, here's my transform rules, and it will start to transform that process and say, well, you had it called this, but we're going to transform it to be called this on the way out. So we do the claim mappings comes first. So all of those claims that you've added get mapped and done. Then we augment. So after transformation has taken place, which means we've grabbed them from AD or whatever else, and we've dropped them into the token, we're now going to augment and say, go and get me PeopleSoft data. And then inject that information directly into that flow. So we add new claims. If you're building one of these from scratch and you're a dev, then this is where you're going to get output claims and you're going to be injecting stuff at that point. Then it's going to pass those. So bear in mind, that's just the gateway. That's just the Federation service. That's done that process. Now what it's going to do is it's going to send it to SharePoint. And SharePoint has its own identity provider, kind of secure store, the STS built into SharePoint. And what's it going to do? It's going to look for augmentation again. We may have injected some process that says, well, you know what? I know they were called this and they came from here. We're now going to change them again and we're going to call it this. Or we're going to add something else. Or we're going to inject something at that point. Once we've gone through all of that process, so what's going to happen right now? We started off with nothing. We got some attributes. We injected a whole bunch more. We renamed everything on the way out. And now I can go to the SP security model inside SharePoint. It hits SharePoint and then says, hold on a minute. Are you authenticated? Yes, you are. I trust you. And then it starts to rip through that piece of XML that's embedded inside the authent token and starts to go through the process, and then we can access the site. That's how the process works. It's really straightforward. Honestly, it's not that many boxes. It's really straightforward how that process works. But you have complete control of how that works. So when you're thinking of authorizing a user and trying to give them access to some kind of content and data, if you think of this process as you go through, you can then say, well, actually, I want all the users to come in via this level of security, and then I would like to assign permissions using a bunch of attributes versus security groups. I've been to a bunch of client sites where they have thousands and thousands of Active Directory groups to accommodate all kinds of weird scenarios when really we don't need to do that because you've created an Active Directory group. So how many of you have AD groups with less than 5 people in them? Come on, put your hands up. There's a whole bunch of you. Because it does. It's like, well, how are we going to secure that? Let's make an AD group. And then you have 50,000 AD groups that have 2 people in them. Instead, if we had a SAML-based authentication, we could just use attributes. You want to assign that to chief execs or specific responsibilities, or you're pulling something from a line of business application, which is based on the kind of projects they work on, then we can take attributes of the projects they're assigned to and assign permission, instead of actually saying, well, create me a security group for that and add them in. So we have more scope as we go through the process. So what about OAuth? This is that mystical thing that has been around for quite some time that everybody's avoided. So OAuth, the definition of OAuth is that basically it's approving application use without passing credentials. That's really what that's about. I don't want to present my credentials to something that I'm trying to get access to. How did we get around that before? We wrote all of our code as runners elevated. So all the developers in the room, have you ever wrote code that runs as elevated privileges? You don't have to confess to that. But that's how you got around it. How did you get around it? Well, the end user doesn't need access to that list, so what am I going to do? Run with elevated. Done. And what does run with elevated run as? Which account? Application pool. Application pool has what permission? That's correct. The almighty. That's the permission that the SP app pool has. So we're now running a piece of code that we wrote or one of your devs wrote. It could be the junior dev that doesn't know how to write code and he's wrote it in elevated privileges, and you're like, I'm cool with that. Really? And you've deployed it on an environment that's not configured in least privilege mode. Ah, see. That's another question to think about. We'll talk about that in a minute. So this is the abstraction and authorization components of SharePoint. It's about moving you away from SharePoint as far as possible and getting you to go into SharePoint and authorize stuff. Every time I'm... It uses tokens, and tokens can have durations assigned to them. And it's really built around this whole idea of trust. And this is the most important thing. It does not reveal credentials or the data they've been using. No credentials get passed. And that's great, because I'm slightly paranoid about everything. And I'm sure there's a bunch of people in the room that are slightly paranoid about everything too. That's why I spent some time building I now use Tor for the majority of everything that I do. So, authentication. It's used inside the app model. This is kind of like the Facebook idea. Anybody use those? Anybody get those stupid requests in Facebook to play games? Are any of you sending those? Because if I find out, I get tons of these things. I don't even know what these are. I'm going to play Farmville. Quite clearly, I have time on my hands to an imaginary farm. That's what I want to look after. Yeah. So we use an app model. It's used to authorize, like the Facebook idea. So you say, I authorize this, or the way Twitter works, where you authorize access. So we're not actually passing credentials. We're just authorizing a process. SharePoint Store can be based on using Windows Azure for ACS, or you can use Windows Azure ACS plus kind of user-defined permissions. So the app permission's based on this. It's this. It's this trust. This is just the best window ever. This is the best window ever designed in SharePoint. What do you do? You go to the App Store and you say, I'm going to buy that. Click. And it goes, do you trust it? Yes, I do. Trust it. It doesn't really say anything. It just goes, you have full. Let it have full control to the site. Well, why would I not? It doesn't say, if you don't, this won't work. It just says, this is the permission we're going to let you have. And then you have to trust it. But of course, if you build an app properly, then you'll never use full control. So just remember that. You're building an app. Obviously, if it's full control, it's not going to go in the Microsoft Store because they're not going to let you do that. But if you're going to sideload it, you shouldn't be using full control anyway, because that's just bad coding. Because now you're back to trying to run stuff as elevated again, which was bad the first time around. So you're going to run it with specific permissions. You're going to say site collection permission or web permission or the specific list permission that you need the app to connect to. So when we're looking at building stuff, you need to isolate those permissions. And obviously, the different types of apps. I mean, obviously, I'm not going to bore you with all the app stuff, but there's a whole bunch of mechanisms of doing this, hosting them kind of inside SharePoint, cloud hosting, whatever it might be. So authorization for the permissions. We can authorize it using user individual permissions. We can use app and user permissions or just app permissions. You can assign it and say, I need this and this and this to be able to utilize those apps. The two types that we have server-to-server, which would be the two-legged approach. We have the high-trust apps, which is the SSL certificate, which I quite like, which is it's all encrypted SSL trust. Now, just as a common theme here, you want to be more secure. We're going to be using SSL certificates for the communication between each other. But don't get me wrong. SSL certificates are not the answer to security. How many times have you had the conversation, or maybe you were part of this conversation, where you were like, you know what, let's make it secure. Let's put an SSL certificate on it. Because quite clearly, that makes it secure. Even though that the SSL and the TLS are almost at the point of being broken. As the hacker group out in Europe, they're very, very close to doing some research on breaking the TLS requirements so they can break in the SSL certificates. Plus, you're stuck with potentially man-in-the-middle attacks. So you have the ACS, which is a three-legged approach, which I quite like. But then you have this one, man-in-the-middle attack. Man-in-the-middle attack is fantastic. Anybody use Fiddler? Yep. The best tool for doing man-in-the-middle attacks ever. And everyone's like, what? I'm not doing that. Yeah, you kind of are. If you turn around and say, I'd like to decrypt the SSL packets, that's a man-in-the-middle attack. Man-in-the-middle attack is basically, here's the site, oh, decrypt SSL, and I can see everything. Fantastic tool. There's a whole bunch of other tools you can get on the Linux framework that are way better. If you want to use Metasploit, fantastic. But you can do man-in-the-middle attacks. Apps are just the same. We can also do authentication replay processes. So building an app You need to spend some time designing the app securely so we can't perform a man-in-the-middle attack, or we can't perform an authentication replay process to take stuff that's already gone through and replay it back again so we can get into the site. So the reason this was built, and you should be looking at it, is because it's all about complementing link, exchange, and allowing all of that stuff to work together. It was built for online services, and of course, you can generate temporary tokens and access. It's really built around just abstracting you away from that SharePoint environment as far as possible. Okay, so let's talk about protecting. So we've authorized everybody, they've authenticated, we've made sure they can't get to the stuff they're not supposed to get to, but what are we trying to protect? What are we protecting against? So let's talk about that. Let's talk about protecting content. Is your content important to you? Quite clearly not. No, no one says anything. No, but your content is important. You may not personally think it's important, but I'm sure the people that are working on that content, it's important to them. That's why they've got 700 copies of it on their machine, just in case. Or they've put it on USB drives, or they've emailed it, or they've put it in Dropbox, or OneDrive, sorry. They will put it into there. That's where they're saving it. So how do we protect content? Well, we can do location-based. We can do URL path classification. So a simple example would be managed paths. One of the most underused ways of securing content. Now, it's not security. It's about abstraction. So we're trying to kind of hide the fact that we have content. So let's give you an idea. We're building a public-facing website. It has some internal components that are just for staff. What we do is we split everything out into site collections. We have a managed path that's public and a managed path that's private. And then we publish the SharePoint site to the world. See, now the private stuff's available. Well, we change the firewall and say, if it happens to have this in the path, then don't let it go outside. So we're segmenting content into containers and blocking how you get to that. We're not securing it. We're physically stopping you from getting to those locations, like you would do now with any kind of rule-based kind of idea. So we can break things out into separate site collections and do stuff. We could do taxonomy classification, only show data based on tagged taxonomy values. A little bit more complicated. Some of the out-of-the-box ones will let you aggregate stuff. So if we take the search web parts, for example, we could do that. But obviously, if you want individuals to see content that's based on taxonomy values that they have assigned to them. Has anybody noticed how that's missing in SharePoint? That I can create a user profile field that's associated to a taxonomy value, and I can select values like interests, and then I can do nothing with it. Because you can't then say, go and get me the content that's related to the interest that I selected in my user profile. So there's an idea for you to write some code. It's actually not that complicated either to go in the user profile and say, get me the interest and find me the content. But you can only show that. So we're not really securing the content because we're leaving SharePoint to do that. SharePoint does it really, really well. If you have access, it shows it. If you don't have access, it doesn't show it. Unless you've messed up the security and then it shows everything. Which happened, it would have been a year or so ago. The National Guard in Mississippi, anybody know this one? They had a SharePoint site, public and private, separate scopes for searching. Somebody decided to misconfigure the search, and all of the internal human resources personnel data appeared on the public-facing website. How is that even possible? But that happened. So we can do that. Permission-based. This is what we do now. Security groups, roles. This is NTFS permissions. That's what we do. We secure SharePoint like we're doing folder structures using NTFS. That's what we do right now because that's what we know. It's hard for us to abstract and go the other way. This is what we should be doing, looking at claim attribute based, being able to say, this is the attribute I want to use. Stop tying us to lots of security groups to be able to get in and out of stuff. Use attributes, it's going to be much cleaner. And then, of course, we could use the new service. We could use request management service in 2013, which allows me, for example, request management is great because you can route requests across the farm and say, whenever I want to get a PDF, send it to this specific server to get that. But we can route requests based on specific parameters. So you could inherently route certain individuals and traffic in certain places. So what about encryption? Anybody using rights management? Yep, about the three or four people that do. I think this is fantastic. It's just not adopted very well. Rights management is great. It's client-based, has the server component, and this complements the baseline security. Because what tends to happen is, the reason I get a phone call to look at SharePoint with some security issues from some of the guys at work, they'd be like, well, I don't know why the permission's not working. It's not inherited, the inheritance is broke, and it's not quite working. But if we had rights management, and all of us in the room had access to that file, but I only wanted Bob to get access to it with me, I wouldn't change SharePoint permissions. I wouldn't need to. I could apply the permission inside rights management. So the fact that you can all see it is great, but when you open it, it's going to change and it's going to be restricted. And it also means that when I try to steal that content, because obviously I steal content quite frequently, I'm going to take that and I'm not going to be able to do anything with it because I don't have access to the rights management infrastructure. And do you know what? We did a test with this years and years ago when it first came out, and I had a client that came to me and said, we would like rights management, and you have to prove to me that it can't be hacked. It's like, really? That's not even my product. Like, yes, check, I can tell you it's unhackable. We know that nothing is unhackable. So we know what we did. We installed SharePoint. We installed rights management. We put a document into SharePoint. We put a rights management policy on it. We opened up Word, opened the document, so it decrypted to open, and then they turned the machine off. Then they took the hard drive out of the machine, connected it up to another device, found the fragments of the document, and then tried to open them and hack them. They couldn't do it. Because based on the lockbox DLL security encryption in the header of the file, they could not get access to that. And then they bought rights management. Fantastic. And it worked really, really well. We've got file and drive. Anybody using BitLocker like me? Isn't it awful? I shouldn't say that. It's actually really, really good as a product, but like I'm using a Lenovo laptop, which has two graphics cards. And sometimes you have to change the graphics cards. And you change the graphics cards, and when you boot it back up, you can't get back in because you've changed the configuration, and BitLocker says, no. Then I have to call up support, and they give me a 57-character thing to type in so I can get it to work. But yes, but this is great. But you can use this with SharePoint. We have the flexibility of using this on our servers, and this should be something you're looking at. You should be encrypting content because the people, I mean, I can only imagine that whoever was in control of the Adobe issue when they took the source code, got a serious slap. Like, was it encrypted? Did you keep the public and private keys in the same location? Like, how did that work? SQL encryption, this is one that we should be looking at. Obviously, we get performance kind of degradation slightly when we move to that one, but this is great to use. We're gonna use TDE in SQL, and you can do it on a per content specific basis. So it's not server-wide setting, like, go, everything encrypted. You can say, actually, this site collection content database or this web app, I want that to be secured. I want to use TDE for that. And of course, you can't restore it without the private key. Don't do what a client did before, where they did TDE and left the private key on the same server where the backups are being taken. So I've managed to hack the server, and I've got your SQL, and oh, the private key's right there. I can restore it. That's not what you want. Obviously, take that somewhere else. Not on the same server. But that's great because you're protecting the content. So even if the end user gets all the way in and I manage to get in, so I do a lot of tests like online, and I am very, very surprised at the amount of SharePoint environments that I find on the internet that have remote desktop enabled to them. Why would you need remote desktop enabled to the SharePoint environment on the internet? And the port's not changed. You know, it's like a two-second job to change the port so remote desktop is not 3389 that everybody knows. But it's on there. It's not even restricted to a policy of, well, it should be this subnet that's coming in. It's just on the internet. 9 times out of 10, when I find one of those, they also have SMTP installed, available for me to send emails to whoever I feel like, and a whole bunch of other stuff. And you can download a tool. I won't tell you what it is, but you can do remote desktop brute force at that point. And then, of course, if I get on your box, if I get to that point, it doesn't really matter what security you've got because you broke the golden rule of not securing it at the endpoint where you were supposed to. So, protecting the infrastructure. How are we going to do this? This one's a big one. Who does this now? You just publish SharePoint to the internet and it pops a Windows login box. Come on. You're telling me no one does that? I am honored. Now you're lying. This is the inherent way that people publish SharePoint. They go, I've got to action it. I've got to publish it. Done. And then a Windows login box comes up when you try to log in from outside and you type in username and password. Why are we doing this? Why are we not reverse proxying? Why are we not using a forms base? Why are we not doing delegated auth to another platform that can do this for us? Because what actually happens when you do this process, which is what happens at your desk, we talked about this morning, is that when you access the site and the box comes up, the box is not from SharePoint. It's not from the firewall. That authentication request is from the physical server you've connected to. So by the time you've typed in HTTP SharePoint, it's gone through the firewall, it's ran down the port 80 traffic, or SSL, depending which way it is, and when it's gone there, then IIS turns around and says, hello, and you get the login box. So you're already at the server, all the way through, because someone said, come in. So you get to the box, you authenticate, and it sets you into there. Stop doing this. Obviously, the problem is that we used to have products that could do this for us, like UAG or TMG or whatever, they disappeared now. But there's other platforms you can use this for. Or you can use the web application proxy that comes with Windows Server 2012 R2, which will do some of this for you. You can take the web application proxy, front it with ADFS, and do pre-auth before they can auth to get all the way through. So stop just publishing the Windows login, because I can find those, and there's about three tools you can find, if you look hard enough, that will do Windows brute force attacks on a Windows login box. And all I have to do is figure out what your admin account is. That's actually a lot easier than you think, because it's normally administrator, because no one changes the administrator name, or they try to be smart and go, $admin, because no one knows that one, or they go, _admin. Yeah, I never understand that. It's like, it is secure, you will never guess it, _admin. Oh. So yes, and you just, okay, here we go. So utilize firewall technology, utilize multi-factor authentication. This should be a given now. Why would you not want to use multi-factor authentication now? Whether it's a separate PIN you have to put in, whether it's an SSL certificate, whether you're in the military and it's a smart card, it makes no difference. Why would you not use multi-factor authentication? Would you access your bank with just a password now? Anybody who does is like, So the bank that I bank with HSBC, because I did when I lived in the UK, but I bank with them here. And in the UK, when I moved out here, they sent me, I have an RSA secure token that's specifically for my bank account. I have a username, a password, a PIN, and an RSA token to get in. It takes me 50 million attempts to get into it because I keep forgetting what it is and I never press the button in time and it times me out. But we should be looking at multi-factor authentication now. So what do we have? We can use certificate services or we can go the Azure multi-factor services, which I'm going to be talking about later on today. The multi-factor process from Azure, either for on-prem or in the cloud, that's what we should be using. This is so important that they enabled the service in Office 365. That's how important this is, that even in the ultra-secure Office 365 environment, they enabled multi-factor authentication because it's no longer good enough. You need something else. So how do we protect SQL? Stop using SQL Server standard ports. What are they? Yeah, 1433, 34, and a whole bunch of other UDP ports. But stop using them. Everyone knows what they are. I can download a tool off the internet, and it will do a SQL injection attack because it looks for 1433 everywhere. It's really straightforward. Everyone knows that. So change them. If you're using like Windows Azure services, so I have Windows Azure services. I have like a 10-server farm in my Windows Azure account, and I have different ports. So when you connect to SQL, it's a different port on the outside as it is on the inside, and my SharePoint servers use a SQL alias to get to it over a specific port. Is that security? Nope. It's just hiding something. It's making it a little bit more complicated for someone to figure out that that's a SQL server. Even though if you're a good hacker, you'll already realize that that's a random port that nothing normally sits on, so we're going to try that one. Listen on a non-standard port. Pick something completely random. And don't use your birth date or anything like that. I've seen people use the year they were born or today's. If you do a scan and go, that'll be that one. Implement Windows firewall policies. Stop turning the firewall off. Windows firewall was built into the OS for a very specific reason. It was to stop the Windows machines getting viruses all the time when they connected to the internet. My brother, well, one of my brothers, he has this issue. He got that many viruses that I told him to go and buy a Mac. That's how bad it was. He had a Windows machine. He had a Windows machine, and every time he plugged it in, he got a virus within about 10 minutes. I could not understand this. I'm like, what do you do? I was like, you know what? You need to get one of those little kiddie phones with the four buttons, and you need a Mac. And you know what he did? He bought a Mac, and he's fine now. Utilize group policies. We should be utilizing group policies. Put the servers in specific OU, specific policies, and lock those servers down. It's all about least privilege. What about the webs? The web and application servers. Implement firewall policies. Utilize group policies. Utilize claim attributes. And I know I joked about SSL certificates, but actually use it. And don't get the cheapest one you can get that does like 128-bit encryption. Go for the big bad boy. Do 4096 or keep going. Get the highest one you can get, because trust me, you're going to need it. When they break the TLS encryption for the lower levels, what are you going to do? Just leave it? Because they're this close to doing it. So protection in general. Implement firewall layers between the server layers. Now, this is a bit over the top, a bit excessive, but this works really well. Historically, before we had all the firewall infrastructure, we used to do IPsec policies on the servers. So you would say, this server can talk to that server and that server, and it became very, very complicated because you had IPsec policies running all over the place. But now we can stick a firewall in between. You're using virtualization platforms, whatever product it might be using, they have the capability to have virtualized firewalls in between to restrict by access control and ports access to those servers. If your servers don't need that port open to it, why have you opened it? Well, because it says in the Microsoft documentation that all these ports are needed, not on every server, on specific roles. So block down the traffic. So the real world example, remember all those years ago, let's see how old everybody is, all those many, many moons ago, the I love you virus came out. Remember that one? That was a pain in the backside, wasn't it, that one? How did that work? It worked by everybody being stupid. That's how that worked. Because you got an email, you're like, someone loves me. Click. And it went everywhere. That's how that worked. But it did. It did that. And that was the problem. So what do we do? Now, bear in mind, the I love you virus should never have gone to any of the servers. How would it ever get to us? How would a malware infect a server? Well, if you leave all the ports open, then when most viruses try to do an SMB connection to another server, it gets to it and goes, oh, IPC dollar, sweet, straight in. Then it's on the server. But if you've blocked that down and you can only communicate between certain machines, that would never happen. And there's a lot of malware right now. In the Target hack, if that had been done, it would never have worked, because it would never have proliferated between the servers and the terminals because they were locked down. But they weren't. Use the best practice security analyzer and the hardening guides. They are available online. Microsoft do take time to actually write documentation once in a while. And this one actually works pretty well. What about protecting the ports? The two famous ports that everyone knows, 80 and 443. If you don't need any of those ports, don't open them to the servers. Just because I've got to add that rule. Some of the firewalls I've seen will literally say, what traffic are you sending? Well, I'm sending this, and it just opens ports for you. Go back and customize those to be the only ports that you need. The SQL ports we talked about, if you need port 25, put it on a specific server. Don't just add it to, I'll put it on all the web servers. Because 9 times out of 10, they follow the documentation, it gets installed, no one actually blocks relaying, and then people like me can send 1,000 emails just to anyone. And then I can do a telnet connection to that to see what it will let me do. It uses file and print sharing services. There's a whole list of them right here. Some of these you'll actually need, but if you don't need NetBIOS over TCP, then disable those ports. They are not needed. Then you've got communication between the web servers. We're going to do HTTP TCP binding, 32843. Anybody know what that one's used for? Yep. Service applications run across those. There's HTTPS versions of those also. Then it uses net TCP binding, but that's normally for specific things that are being built. Communication between all the farm servers when you're using Kerberos should be using TCP, UDP, ATA, and blah, 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 blah. There's a whole bunch of ports. There's even more. Here's a diagram. I'll give you a list of the diagram. There's a whole bunch of them right there. You can look at this diagram. You can get the link off the slide deck, but that's all the ports. That's the communication flows. There's actually another diagram you can see which shows the flow between everything. You guys need to understand that. That you put the servers in and just stick them behind a firewall and everyone thinks it's good to go. It's really not. Because who are we protecting against? Who are you protecting against? Me? Well, obviously. Obviously. Because I'm going to get a list of who you lot are. And we're going to try and hack now. But who are we protecting against? You're protecting against yourself. You're protecting against staff. You're protecting against vendors. You're protecting against the anonymous user or the kid next door who's a script kiddie. Who thinks they're a script kiddie? Come on, fess up to it. If you don't know what a script kiddie is, who's taken a script off the internet that somebody else wrote and used it? That makes you a script kiddie. Because you didn't write it. What did you do? Check it and validate it? Who's installed Coplex solutions on a production environment? Get out of the room now. Unless you took the code and you validated the code and you recompiled it yourself, you should slap yourself for a while. They may be great solutions, but why would you just take something random? If you took a third-party vendor product, have you checked it? There's a third-party vendor product that's out there that if you access the right URL, it will issue me the user's email address, their SIP address, and their account. It's in the vendor product. And you can do a search on Google or Bing, whichever one you like, and you can see websites that expose that vulnerability. It's in the product. And it's in the product that much that the crawl engines can find it. Protection is only as good as what you implement. Log the traffic. Love this one. Authentication traffic is now logged extensively in 2013, way better than it was before. These last two, we know that none of you do this because it's too much effort. It's like, what, I got to... Who reads the ULS logs? Nope. You read the ULS logs when there's an error. Nobody actually reads them or monitors them like they should do. Because if you did, you would see other things. Who looks at the IIS logs? Well, I do when there's an issue. Why are we logging stuff in the first place if we're not going to look at the logs? Review the logs, review the server logs. Implement alerting mechanism for breaches. You should now be actively monitoring what's going on to look for those breaches. Specific port access, malformed XML posts into SharePoint, because that's a way of getting in. We can do a malware post, a piece of XML, structured incorrectly, post it into SharePoint, and I can get in. Or I can access some endpoints. So we have a bunch of endpoints. Let me just see what time it is. We've got about a minute, so let me just do this. So the list of endpoints. So here's a list of it. These are all the endpoints of SharePoint. So these are all, you recognize some of these, recycle bin, blah, 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 blah. Those are endpoints. Those are endpoints of SharePoint. And I can take any of those endpoints. So for example, if I go, let's do this one. I'm just going to copy that one. And I'm going to go to, I'll use the other Bing for now. And I'm going to do that. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to see SharePoint environments that are now exposing things anonymously to me outside. Now, maybe they're public-facing sites. Maybe they're not public-facing sites. If your site's up there, just don't say anything. it's much easier that way. But there's a whole bunch of sites. And you can do all kinds of different things. If you really want to have fun, you can even go to places like this. And you can see there's lists of user accounts all over the place, passwords, email addresses. This is stuff that's in SharePoint that's available to me as an anonymous user. I don't actually think this one's supposed to be available. I mean, come on, the airborne corpse, I really don't think they're supposed to be there. But you can do a whole bunch of stuff. I have a whole bunch of other, but I'm not going to... I might get in trouble for that. Yeah, I do have a different session that covers that one, but not here. So review the logs, implement that one. So... test the security. What do I mean by that? That means actually test it. Don't just say, is it okay? Like, try and get in. Test security from the inside. Test it like an end user. Don't test it with the admin account. Well, it works for me. That doesn't really help. I'm the admin. I want to test it as an end user or anonymous user trying to access stuff I shouldn't do. Test the search results. This is one that we do every single time we launch a client. We go in and say, well, let's do some tests. Let's see what I'm not. Let's do a search for payroll. Let's do a search for salary. Let's do a search for like a whole bunch of weird words. That's the first thing I like to do sometimes. You put SharePoint in, you have it crawl the shared drives, and then do a search for what it finds. It's fantastic. Then they'll realize that the security's been wrong the entire time. Test security from the outside. There's no excuse. Be a hacker for a day. Buy yourself a black hat, become a black hat hacker for a day. Use the pen test tools to scan your environment. There's a whole bunch. Use things like Nmap or W3AF. Go and get some Linux tools or whatever else and scan your environment. Or just give me a call and we'll have a chat. We can make that happen for you. And always be on your guard. This is the bit where really most of the security breaches that have taken place this year have either been because of misconfiguration or really smart hackers. But really smart hackers only exploit vulnerabilities which are misconfiguration or code exploits. It's not like they're magically breaking into the data center and just walking through the front door and going, I'm going to get the stuff. They are exploiting things. So if you configure your SharePoint environment incorrectly, then of course the problem's going to be that I'm going to be able to find that, and then I'm going to be able to exploit that, and before you know it, we're going to take all the content out of your site. I mean, a few targeted searches on the internet will show me a whole bunch of stuff about your organization. I can see SharePoint environments, I can see documents, I can see user profiles, I can go in and call the web services if I wanted to, I can make a call to the web services externally. There's a vulnerability that was in SharePoint 2010 and 2007 that's kind of been fixed, sort of. But if you misconfigure SharePoint, I can call the ASMX web services directly from my machine and rip out all of your user profiles. I did it as a live test in another session, and I did 25,500 user accounts and email addresses in about 35 seconds flat because I was able to call the web services that were misconfigured incorrectly, and I could pull that information down. So you should be scared. Not of me, just be scared in general, because misconfiguration means that you will end up causing an issue, and when you have a breach like Adobe, one of you lot will get slapped. And that's not what you need. So let's do security properly. Let's make sure that we apply the right policies and things like that. Final thoughts. Ask yourself four questions. How are they coming in? Who is it that's coming in? Are you aware of who's coming in? When are they coming in? And why are they coming in? Ask yourself those four questions, and ask those questions before you put SharePoint in. Don't wait till it's in and then go, hey, you know what would be cool? If we could just make everybody get access to everything. Think about it first, work out the process flows, diagram it out and say, these ones from here, business hours, ADFS. These ones from here, internal AD. These ones from here, never going to get in. And then block and build the policies around that one. So make sure you evaluate the sessions on MySPC. And thank you for coming to the session. If you have any questions, I'll be at the front.